30 years in the environmental movement, where it has become not about saving wild places and wild creatures so much. There are still many who are doing it this way, but I'm talking really about the environmental intelligentsia, who I just can't stand, who it's become about sustaining this way of life that's killing the planet.
Is he dead or underneath here to receive us when changes fail? May this shovel loose your trouble, let them fall away. Well, the mist shall be your blanket, while the moss is your head, as the future is so forgotten, as the dirt shall be your bed, as there's a dirt floor underneath. Till receive us when changes fade. May this shovel loose your trouble, let them fall away.
Your school systems won't teach you. Your scientists will not document it.
There's a great poem by the poet Robert Aiken that says, "Watching gardeners label their plants, I vow with all beings to practice the old horticulture and let plants identify me." The movement into understanding Gaia as a living intelligence forces a change in orientation that is substantial. I think it's too often forgotten in the drive to develop sophisticated Gaian understandings that relationship with the Earth is at root a feeling thing, not a thinking thing. Of all of the difficulties I have faced personally and that I think face us as a species, this is, I believe, one of the hardest. The changing of personal orientation from mental constructs, from theoretical analysis and thought to feeling. For in so doing, we experientially encounter a basic conflict of cultural values and assumptions within which we are daily immersed, specifically that feeling is inferior to thinking. We have lost, as James Hillman comments, the response of the heart to what is presented to the senses, and that loss can be seen daily in the environmental devastation of our world. It can also be seen, though it is somewhat harder to perceive, in a concomitant devastation of our interior worlds. Part of this is that we often denigrate our capacity to feel or apologize for its emergence. More seriously, we no longer understand that feeling can be raised to the same level of sophistication as thinking, that the heart is an organ of perception and cognition equal and perhaps superior to the brain in its capacities. For its use automatically engenders empathy with, as well as understanding of, complex ecosystem interdependencies. Its use automatically involves caring. This caring itself is crucial. It allows the emergence of complex understandings not accessible to the brain. Some things have to be felt to be seen. As Barbara McClintock commented about her work with corn transposons, you must have a feeling for the organism. And as George Washington Carver said, anything will give up its secrets if you love it enough. This internal shift has been the primary effect in my life of recognizing Gaian interconnection and intelligence as real phenomena. It is, I think, the fundament upon which deeper insights about Gaia and complex Gaian interdependencies rests. Years ago, Brooke Medicine Eagle said to me, "My teachers have told me this, the trees are the teachers of the law. And as I grow less ignorant, I begin to understand what they mean." I love that statement, not only for the depth of perception about trees and their ecosystem function, but because I have found that the journey into Gaian understandings continually involves growing less ignorant. Much of what I've been taught, I've found, is untrue. The knowledge base gained from technological schooling is itself more often than not an ignorance that must be abandoned. Once I truly allowed myself to go into nature and see what was there for myself, the world I found bore little relationship to the one I was taught about in school.
I love this line by David Ehrenfeld. Nature's not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we can think. The Earth ecosystem is incredibly sophisticated, very intelligent, and it's been around as a living organism for 3.5 billion years, and it's dealt with a lot of impacts to its viability. So there's a lot of redundancy built into the system, because redundancy helps any organism respond to environmental challenges. So there's a lot of plants that tend to be similar to other plants that are in existence. But what a lot of the researchers are talking about are saying, you know, the redundancy is built in for a reason. And, you know, and Aldo Leopold is really great. He goes, you know, one of the first kind of premises of intelligent tinkering is to save all the parts.
Exactly. You don't want anything to roll away.
When plants begin to disappear from an ecosystem, what happens is you get what's called a trophic cascade. That means the ecosystem begins to collapse from a high degree of complexity to a lower level of complexity. And that makes it less able to respond to ecosystem challenges. And when that starts happening a lot of places around the globe, what you start getting is these really wild gyrations in environmental functioning. I mean, you know, the stuff we see in the news, look, by the time the newspapers begin to report something, you got to realize the trouble's been going on a long time, and it's a lot deeper than they're ever going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the focus tends to be on global warming or ozone depletion or a few things like that. The factors involved in ecosystem disruption, there's several hundred of them, all of them equally as serious as global warming. One of them is the damage to plant species, just say from a monocropping in agriculture. You know, most people actually think farming is what's happening in the United States. Well, it's not really. It's like hydroponics, only they're not using water as the medium. They're using earth as the medium. It's like humusponics or something. And The soil is just a thing to hold the root system. It's not alive anymore. It's not a living thing like humus normally would be. And so we see those plants, and we're under some assumption that there's still living things there. But monocropping reduces plant diversity in ecosystems, and what you start to get is the degradation of complexity of response to environmental perturbations in the ecosystem, and that leads to things like Hurricane Katrina and a whole lot of things. You get these wild gyrations that can't be controlled, and that will get worse and worse over time as the ecosystem attempts to reestablish homeodynamics. And it's way beyond the point right now that we can do much about it. We're trying to hold on. It's just like anybody going into psychotherapy, you know, and I worked as a psychotherapist for a very long time. They come in and, you know, and they're engaging in this behavior that's making them completely unhappy, and it's not working. And you say, well, you need to change this behavior. And they go, yeah, but can I keep the behavior and just fix this other stuff? And it just, you can't. The underlying ideas, perspective, the way we do stuff, they all have to be changed at an incredibly deep level. And, you know, you might think we're just talking about some wild plant populations that are disappearing, but that goes so deep into what's happening. You just can't. It's such a fundamental problem.
Scientists are finding out that plants communicate.
Like if caterpillars come and start chewing on this leaf here, then the plant will send out messages that tell other plants that the caterpillars are here and you need to change the composition of your leaves to make them less palatable, sending out various chemical messages instead of a chemical language. One guy is trying to make a dictionary of them to find out, okay, this is when you get eaten by this type of caterpillar, this is when there's this other thing. That's 2,500 words and phrases is what he's looking at about. And a lot of plant scientists think that this is complete nonsense because, of course, non-humans can't communicate. Humans are the only ones who have all these special, wonderful, scrumptious things. That's another thing that Chomsky was saying. It was just really hard to take, was that he was saying that he thinks that intelligence is a lethal mutality, that intelligence is what's killing the planet. Intelligence can't survive. Intelligence makes us inherently destructive. And what he's done is the same thing that Richard Dawkins has done. Dawkins says, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump to its own command to predict what will happen and when. And what he's doing is he's conflating domination, which is what he's talking about there, with how we know something's true. It's an extraordinary statement. Just to give a really good example, if I put a gun on you and I say, if you don't jump through a hoop in 3 seconds, I'm going to shoot you, then you jump through the hoop. I just made matter and energy jump through its own command, but don't you think that destroyed our friendship? And it's the same thing with the natural world.
For you can see me in your eyes when they are mirrored by a friend. There is no end to the circle, no end.
There is no end to life, but some lives are stolen, lost to violence and brutality, sacrificed on the altar of war.
I just found this extraordinary, but it's everywhere. The notion that only human creations have value, and that only human creations have, they even call, say, true function. So a river has no true function. It only has functionality when humans use it. And that's an extraordinary thing, because if you believe that, what that means is you can take the salmon out of the forest, you can believe you can take the salmon out of the forest, and it won't matter because they have no true functionality. The only true functionality is human functionality. It's like I was looking at this list from the Atlantic Magazine. I was looking at this list from the Atlantic Magazine of 50 of the greatest achievements of all time. And there were things like antibiotics. But okay, so I'm going to ask you a trick question here.
Yes.
Who discovered antibiotics? The proper answer that people normally give is Alexander Fleming.
Uh-huh.
So say Alexander Fleming.
Alexander Fleming.
No, that's wrong, actually. Okay, so now let's go back. It's like, actually, there was this French guy, I believe, in the 19th century who discovered that a lot of Arab stable boys working for the French military would keep their saddles in moist areas, and it ends up it was because that helped the horses get over saddle sores. And it's like, so it was French, it was Arab stable boys. Well, wrong.
I would argue that that's also wrong, because you're taking a colonial perspective of who discovered what. You know, indigenous cultures have known for thousands of years how to treat, you know, local diseases, how to keep themselves, you know, healthy and in balance.
Of course. I completely agree with that. But that, I'm going to take it further back still. You know who really discovered antibiotics?
Yeah.
Fungus. Because it's the fungus who created it in the first place. They're the ones who figured it out. And the reason is because the fungus wanted to make the antibacterial. You know, they got to eat this thing, whatever it was, before the bacteria. It's like, I don't want to give this all to the bacteria. They can eat that over there. I want to eat this. And so I started thinking about, like, the 50 greatest pieces of art. You know, or 50 greatest... You know, I think one of the greatest pieces of art is sunset. And what about the song of a meadowlark? What about a monarch butterfly? What about a dragonfly? Isn't that a beautiful piece of art? No, it's only the Michelangelo of David. No, it's like, if humans create it, it can be art. But if the real world creates it, it doesn't count as art. It doesn't count as an achievement. What about metabolism? Isn't that a great thing? What about proprioception? That's how you know. This weird thing one night where I woke up in the middle of the night and I was going to get a drink of water. And this has only happened to me one night. I couldn't find my mouth with my hand to give myself a glass of water with the lights off. And so I started thinking about that. That's proprioception. It's how we know where our body is, where parts of our body are. You know, if you put your hand behind your back, you still know where your hand is. And it's a necessary thing in order to walk, in order to do anything. And what an extraordinary invention. You know, isn't that a cool thing? And what about photosynthesis? Isn't that an amazing invention? My point is that it's really deeply ingrained in us that if humans create it, it's a big thing. And it's, whoa, this amazing discovery. But if non-humans create it, well, it's no big deal, and it can be replaced, and it's not even true functionality. I just find that absolutely extraordinary. When I was thinking of wonderful inventions, you know, can you really think of a better invention than a berry? What a great idea that what you do is you make this wonderfully attractive package for your seed that then somebody eats it, and they derive nourishment from it. It helps them, and then they fly away, and they poop out your seed, and so they transfer your seed somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then not only that, but when they poop out the seed lands in a little pile of fertilizer. It's like, you know, I could think my whole life and I wouldn't come up with an idea that is that good.
Your news media won't tell you. Your planet is at war. A way of life sustained by mechanized resource pillaging is killing you and everything around you. The machine culture is killing you. You do not believe it is real because you have been indoctrinated.
When societies get into trouble, an unconscious response seems to be they search back through their own history to find a model that they can revivify or revitalize. The strongest example in our own history was when the medieval world broke apart and didn't make any sense anymore. The new middle class went back to classicism, to the Greeks and the Romans, to Roman law, Greek philosophy, and to Greco-Roman architecture and mechanics and that sort of thing, and created classicism. Classicism was invented in the 14th century. But our problems are deeper than this. We can't go back to ancient Rome or ancient Egypt or something like that and expect to have real answers.
The voice has said, Antichrist is anti-life. Greed, death's agents taking command. Society conditioned in death. Death to the air. Death to the water. Death to the future. Death in the mind. The voice has said, people strung out in confusion. Dancing at ends of industrial wires, reactionary lives, reactionary minds, forgetting who we are, disguising servitude, fooling ourselves in lies of freedom. The voices said industrial needs, human beings don't really matter. Their labor does. Energy consumed. Submission in many forms is submission not recognized. Material prisons, racial prisons, sexual prisons, chemical prisons, system prisons, angry prisons, slamming cell doors shut. voice that said, "We are Earth's children. The people must stand strong. Our will is our life. Man, respect woman. Brother, help sister. Young, help old. Relative, help relative. Nation, help nation." The voices said, "Entering and leaving, we gather strength. When we know power, we are power. When we know peace, we are peace. When we know the time, we are the time."
We have to go back further to prehistory, to this archaic state. And there, in partnership, in genderless, self-organizing society, we begin to see the kinds of models that we have to somehow recreate in the modern world. Obviously, we can't in the modern world become mushroom-eating nomadic pastoralists, but we can study that approach to reality to try and learn from it how you live in equilibrium. That's the key thing that the archaic world knew that we don't know. How do you live in equilibrium so that your children may live in equilibrium? Because otherwise you get a cycle started that's going to shove somebody over the cliff.
Oh yes, there's just one thing more. Extinction howls outside the door. And no matter what they say, it's a hell of a price to pay for security. And when you see species tumbling down, ask yourself what's real, estate agent or gene. Laid poised at Earth Mother's throat, a nuclear umbrella shields my soul. Yellow cake Bob Hawke got my vote. Uranium mines pay wage or dole, to be or not to be. The final choice, ecology or extinction, raise your voice. Ever since they heard the news, sisters and brothers sing the blues. Shared despair, fear and sorrow, loving each other like there's no tomorrow or yesterday. Be peace on earth, ecology, ecstasy, evolution. Sap coursing through a mammal branch touches you, a trembling human leaf. Send your roots back through the tree of life, shedding false humanistic beliefs. You fall to your knees in some still natural place. Embrace the trees, feel ecology, pierce your heart. Oh yes, there's just one thing more. Extinction howls outside the door, and no matter what they say, it's a hell of a price to pay.
You do not believe it is real because you have been indoctrinated. Your base level understandings of human instinct have been infiltrated and rewired. You have been assimilated. You have been assimilated. You have been assimilated. Fundamental understandings of your humanity have been stripped from you. You exist within a society of product-based resource mongering, and you have been taught to think that this way of life is harmless and acceptable. You are a living organism meant to be sustained by the living organic land base you exist upon. You are not meant to live inside concrete. You are not meant to struggle for financial gain. Your planet is at war. Machine culture is killing you.
I think that human beings have always known that we have access to many different states of consciousness, and that, you know, the kind of consciousness we're most familiar with is really kind of something our culture impresses on us. You know, that kind of like, I'm focused and I'm together and I've got this list of A, B, C, and D to do, and I've done, you know, A and crossed it off and I'm going on to B, you know, right? Right. That kind of consciousness.
Pretty linear and uh-huh. Scientific and Newtonian. And
yeah. You know, that's one way of being. But people who have lived close to nature, been in nature, been in touch with the natural world, and whose lives were integrally bound up with the cycles of the seasons and with the lives of animals and with really knowing the animals, because you had to know them to hunt them and to survive with them. Those people were aware of many other kinds of consciousness and awareness that was as familiar to them as our, you know, get it done kind of consciousness is to us. And I think they were very much aware, you know, what to us seems like an esoteric concept, that other beings have consciousness and are communicating to us, you know. That was no surprise. And not just animals, but animals, plants, you know, all of life, all of nature has an awareness. And it may be very different from ours, but it is an awareness and it is always communicating in many, many different ways. And even scientists now know that the trees, for example, in a forest are linked by an underground network of fungi that transfer chemical messages back and forth. And trees actually feed their young through that web of fungi. They send nutrients down. Trees in the sun will feed trees that live in the shade and share nutrients.
I'm becoming increasingly convinced that the fundamental unit of evolution is the larger community, the forest or the river. They themselves are living beings.
You have to understand that nothing is what you've taken it to be.
We will protect what we value, and we will protect what we love. And right now, what people love most and what people value most are these authoritarian techniques. You know, they value the economy over the real world, and they value so-called human ingenuity over the real world, and they value television over the real world, and they value pretty much everything over the real world. And what they really value is their sense of superiority that is created by all those things.
We're raised, most of the people in the United States anymore, we're raised to look at ourselves pretty much in isolation from anything else around us, except for maybe other people or our jobs or something like that. And the thing is that our species is relatively new, a couple of million years old, depending on how you figure it. But the plants have been here for a very, very long time, hundreds of millions of years. And what's really interesting to me is that, you know, there's a lot of people I admire, and as I start looking at their work, it doesn't matter. A lot of them, their work sort of came out of working with plants, whether that's Rupert Sheldrake or Luther Burbank or Goethe, the great German poet, or Henry David Thoreau. There's this thing that happens when people that have been raised in a kind of a Western culture, when they start interacting more with the plants, it starts pulling them back into this experience that we sort of walked away from a long time ago. And we start finding our essential self, sort of the essential self that emerged out of the ecological matrix of this planet. And rather than us then experiencing a separation between ourselves and nature, we begin, as the great rainforest activist John Seed said, re-inhabiting our inner being with the world. We start being woven back into that living matrix. And once that happens, everything really begins to change.
In fact, if Mother Nature is indeed replete with wisdom and intelligence, then she ought to provide us with an antidote with which to combat our ecological destructiveness, a kind of strong medicine that can instill within us a profound ecological awareness. And Mother Nature does provide such an antidote. Appropriately enough, it grows in the ground.
There's a poem I recite many times a year as I teach. It's by a German poet, Norbert Meyer. Just now a rock took fright when it saw me. It escaped by playing dead. As the meaning of that poem moved into you, many of you laughed. There was a childlike joy in the room. And in that joy, there is a hopefulness that just happens of its own accord. Feels good, doesn't it? It occurs because the poem reminds us of something that we have long known to be true, that the world is alive and intelligent and aware. Just being reminded of it brings a hopefulness automatically. Now contrast that with something Ken Wilber has said. The only thing that you and your rock can share together is that you both fall at the same rate. As the meaning within that penetrates, how you feel changes. And if you sit with it long enough, you'll find that some spark of life leaves, and with it that hopefulness that so automatically was here before. Reductionism itself, seeing the world as unrelated bits, denigrates the most essential part of what it means to be human, our capacity for empathic contact with the other life forms on this planet, and our recognition that whether bacteria or mammal, they are alive and aware and intelligent and capable of communication. All of us and the work we do are part of those invisibles. So I will end with something Walt Whitman said a long time ago. Be not discouraged, keep on. There are divine things well enveloped, I swear to you. There are divine things more beautiful than words can tell.
Into an hour with daughters of starlight, daughters of moon, sisters of sunlight, sisters of blue, brothers of nature, brothers of all. Brothers of legend, like story untold. I had a dream, my goal. I need to rest, gun and sword. Bury the action. Bury the state, but to each other, peace to make. I'm a brown skin man, that's what I am. Got guitar and the drum, that's where I come from. Spirits of the sea, spirits of the sun, body of the shadow, come shine on me. The son of the sun, son of the earth, the soul of life. Children of a world, daughters of starlight, daughters of moon, sisters of sunlight, sisters of earth, brothers of nature, brothers of all, brothers of legend, like story untold.
And this is a style of experience that seems to be common to our indigenous brothers and sisters, and without doubt to our only indigenous ancestors. It is a sense that anything we can sense is also assumed to be a sensitive, even a sentient being, and it's all right. Of course, the other animals, not that they are the same as us, they are each very different. The spider who weaves the cosmos out of its own abdomen and just creates a whole spiraling galaxy or web out of itself. And the humpback whale who swims through the depths of the ocean and sending its eerie glissando cries through miles and miles of liquid ocean to communicate with other humpback whales. So different from our experience up here on the dry earth with our opposable thumbs. But our experience is so very different from that of the soaring hawk hovering above its prey. Each being very different in its experience from the others, and yet the assumption is all of them are just as present, just as awake and aware as we are, but in a very different shape. But not just the other animals, the plants, the trees, the grasses, even whole forests are assumed to be alive and awake. But not just the plants and the other animals, but even the rocks and the mountains have their long, deeply layered experience of us and of the earth. Even the winds and the weather patterns, rivers, dry riverbeds, thunderclouds, particular winds that pour through a mountain pass or another wind that comes rolling up the river valley, only in a certain season and only at a certain time of day in that season. But it's assumed that that wind has its own intelligence, its own life. This experience is very old in us. And it is the way one experiences the world when your animal senses are all awake and listening. Of course, you will be just assuming that everything is alive, or at least potentially alive, because that keeps your ears very attentive, listening to what might be being said by these other beings. And it keeps your skin very awake, feeling for what the world might be feeling. But you cannot empathize with an inert object. And so much more practical then to allow that everything is alive.
The city you live in has destroyed the organic land base that you were meant to cohabitate. The plants and animals of this planet are under attack. You are an animal. You are an animal. You are under attack. The city you live in is killing you and all the people you love. The society you live within has created distractions of power and pleasure to disarm you. The machines are your enemy. You are being attacked by the machine of large-scale industrial progress. Your planet is at war.
Industrial slave. Industrial slave, capitalist and communist imperialist, smiling with false faces, beckoning us with their lies about progress, wanting us to enjoy the rape of Earth and our minds. Industrial slave, fork-tongued legalistic contract chains, turning our visions to technologic nightmares. National security war makers desecrating the natural world, and God still trying to get over what you done to his boy. Industrial slave, material bound, law and order, religious salvation, individually alone, industrial slave. Without earth, there is no heaven. Streets of gold, angels' wings, eternal life. Corporate Reich nuclear regimes maximizing profit, eating identities, plundering natural allies as though earth is dead. Allowing religious right collection plate tributes to church and state. With Christ still hanging from the cross, echoing industrial war cries, warring against body and soul, attacking spirit, lying to enslave with an illusion about freedom. Without earth, there is no heaven. Earth and sky, universal power, life energies, creative flow, in which we are a pattern to keep balance, harmony, a gift, an appreciation to enjoy. Honor life. Without earth, there is no heaven. It's all one big insane mistake being made here. Wage slaves must escape this lifeless cycle. Rage masters fuse his meaningless promises, acidic lies blinding to the mind's eye, surrendering living to submissions get by. Look at yourself in dismal pretense, pretending freedom as though that's a defense. There was a crazy lady shouting from the sidelines, "There are no secrets here, only shames and disgraces." Pavlov's rats snicker at what you don't recognize. You only see what the mirror wants you to see. Craving upward mobility means someone's tied down. Weird bondage trips in straight-laced fashion. Business as usual keeps cracking its profit whip. In the marketplaces of products, you're the main product. Obedience pays, but it doesn't pay enough to break even. Not much of a trade getting ahead for losing your mind. There was a crazy lady shouting from the sidelines, "Babylon is doing again what it's always done before. Fronting its dark side with more new, pretty plastic. Telling you the ticket to heaven is do what they say. Don't look at their hands if you can't handle blood. Don't look at their heart if you can't stand the cold. Each lie you embrace means you blind yourself to your truth, burdening yourself, picking up, carrying Babylon's deceit, paradox, living without vision, dying to see the light, while the sun's on fire, and we're part of the sun."
Mister, take a good look at my country, it's the Eden and the apple of my eye. You come up from your office in the city, I will meet you at the river by and by. I cannot let this
It's like severing our relationship to power is the objective. Under the male dominator creator theory, see, all spiritual value really is removed away from the earth. So the earth isn't your mother anymore. The earth is the dominion and property of this new God, and you are to subdue it. See, that's like Martians landing. It really is, see, because it's a completely different perceptual reality. Going from caring for the earth, all right, to dominating the earth. And incidentally, you know, as a part of this process, see, you created a moral crime for being born. So therefore, you have to listen to the authority of this new male God, because you made a crime for being here. You see, before that was brought here, life was a gift. So when you were born, it was like an exchange of gifts, a gift to a gift. And even dying was like a gift, because it was an exchange of life, because we were part of a spiritual reality as physical beings. But anyway, this other thing, see, changed about there was something wrong with us for being born. See, and it's maybe a big thing, or see, to me, I think it's a major thing, because see, the first time that human being gets this, that they're guilty, right, for being born, it alters their perception of self. It alters them from seeing themselves from the reality of who they are, because they're picking up someone's illusion and they're viewing themselves through the illusion. And the way that that illusion seems to work, see, people don't learn from their guilt. They just make new guilts. See, so it, to me, in the end, it becomes a deal about irresponsibility. So even though all the words are being said, see, it's an irresponsible behavior. It's an irresponsible behavior because we are responsible for what we do. But when they condition us to feel guilty, and then we have to listen to their chain of command and be submissive to them, we are not taking responsibility. And we are not showing respect to our Creator, whoever it is, all right, for the gift of intelligence and life.
Many people would say to me, come on, you are asking us to begin to open up relationships with other animals and with plants and with the ground itself, but we don't even have any half-decent relation with other humans. So don't we need to heal our relationship with others of our own species first before we can really open up and begin to dialogue with the rest of the earth? No, I think that's entirely backwards. Because the reason we don't readily and easily communicate with one another, it seems to me, is because we have shut ourselves off from relationship with the context in which all of our human communication takes place. What's a simple way to demonstrate this? If, suppose for a moment, that there was a creature like us, well, us, that is, as I was saying before, completely co-evolved with the wind and the rain and the savanna and the forests and many other animals, gazelles and deer and even, you know, huge creatures that were quite dangerous, that can eat us and often do take us as prey. So our whole sensorium is evolved to be able to notice and pay attention to the shadows of other creatures and the eyes coming from very different faces from our own furry faces and antler creatures who we hunt. And the whole nervous system itself co-evolved with these many other nervous systems and shapes and textures of life suddenly is born into a context where all of that other life is spoken of as just a set of basically determinate, inanimate objects and purely objective processes that can be quantified and measured. And so the human creature, not knowing how to enter into communication with what is an inert or inanimate or determinate object, doesn't know how to practice any kind of relationship there. So we turn toward the only place where there still is some kind of mystery that is allowed to be a mystery, some kind of enigmatic otherness, is in other human beings. Because, yes, we have our mechanical objective bodies, but we also have our spiritual mind that are something quite different from the rest of nature. And so we turn toward our lovers, our husbands or our wives, for instance, craving still the nourishment that once came from being in active relationship with dragonfly and moonrise and thundercloud and the wind stirring in the grasses and other big winds that come pouring down from the high mountain passes. But instead of having any of that relationship, our nervous system is still, I mean, for a million years, was tuned by those relationships, but now we can only get it from other people. And so we turn toward our partner, wanting all of that otherness. And, well, you know, I really love you, darling, but I'm just not feeling met by you. It's just not working. And she is feeling the same. And in fact, it blows apart so many relationships, one after another, because another human who is shaped so much like us, a nervous system that is basically the same as ours, cannot possibly provide all of that rich, wild otherness that we once, that nourishment we once got from being in active interaction with spiders spinning their webs and the tracks of wolves as we track them across the snowy field, and yes, of huge forest creatures and the forests themselves in their branching powers, and owls and whales and salmon whose, you know, patterns we were so explicitly attuned to when they would come flooding back up into the rivers after 3 years again. But we just speak of the salmon now as a resource. It's not something we relate to. So we turn for relationship to our human community. But the human community can't possibly provide all of that wonder and rich, wild, and dangerous otherness.
The oncoming storm of climate change, the never-before-seen winds tossing down power lines and ripping out trees by their roots, the thudding torrents of rain in some regions, and the long stretches of aridity and heat cracking the soil in others, all are a consequence of our long forgetfulness, of our forgetting the invisible, taking for granted what we could not see. We overlooked that element held most holy by our ancestors, the unseen flux long assumed to be the very source of all awareness, wind mind of the world, the commonwealth of breath. The swelling storms are a simple consequence of treating the atmosphere as an open sewer, a magic dump site for whatever we wish to avoid. Out of sight, out of mind. Or so we thought. But for our oral elders and ancestors, that which dissipates as smoke or dissolves into the unseen air is by that very process slipping into the mind, binding itself back into the encompassing awareness from which our bodies steadily drink the wild sentience of the world, moody with weather. From this angle, climate change is nothing other than what Sigmund Freud called the return of the repressed, the violent resurgence of a once familiar dimension of reality that has long been kept hidden or buried from conscious awareness.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another, Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. Liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate. The unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man. Not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines. The power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful. To make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world. That will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fulfill that promise. Let us free the world. To do away with national barriers. To do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. In the name of democracy, let us all unite.
Now, I'm going to end this show with an appeal on behalf of John Taylor Gatto. Not only has he been one of the most prolific contributors to the show over the years, but has been a great personal inspiration to me. Without John Taylor Gatto, you wouldn't be listening to me now. He continues his recovery from his stroke, but remains hampered by a lack of money. If you have funds and you're looking for a good cause, I can think of no one more deserving. You can donate to him at thejohntaylorgattomedicalfund.com, which I shall link in from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/700. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. A special thanks to Martin of Kaput Radio and Chaz K of Virtual Renderings, whose material inspired the first and second halves, respectively, and I hope you found this show as much of an enjoyment and inspiration to listen to as it was for me to create.
Welcome, guests.